Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober, covering lifestyles in the world of real food. There are many advantages to living a nutrient-dense lifestyle consuming real food. One of the biggest advantages is good digestion. Here to talk with me about digestive issues and good gut health is registered dietitian Laura Mathis of Rest, Digest, and Heal. Laura, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Aaron.
It's a pleasure to have you. I always admired what you do, and I've seen some of the talks you've given, and I think you have a lot of good insights to offer with digestive health, so I appreciate you wanting to make a return to this program.
Thank you.
So I know, since we've talked last, one of the things that you have now is a new online course. What inspired you to start this?
Yeah, I toyed with the idea for a while, and there's a lot of courses out there, so that certainly sparked something within me. I think I could make one, although on the tech end, that was completely daunting to me, but I employed the help of my husband. He actually built the nuts and bolts of it with me creating the content. But the thing that really inspired me was in my practice, I've had a private practice for a decade or so, maybe a little longer now, it starts to add up. But I really was noticing I see so many of the same patterns over and over in my clients. Of course, no two people are alike, but this just very similar patterns. I don't know if I'm attracting the same types of people, this archetype that would be attracted to work with me. But I also think there's something too that just so many people who are experiencing digestive issues come to this place because they've gone through similar things in life or just are the way our food system is. All these factors have built up. So I really found myself repeating myself, and which is fine by me, but I'm like, wow, I really could hone this and make it so many people would access it at once. And I'm saying the same thing to everybody. And that really interested me. And then certainly if someone's like, I've done the course, but I really need more, I still do offer one-on-one individual nutrition counseling. But I'm really focusing on this, like I said, because everything that I talk about in the course is really just what I talk about with everybody. At least starting there has been really great. The other thing that inspired me is just having a child. At this point, I have a three-year-old and I'm primarily a stay-at-home mom, but I still love what I do and really feel called to do this work because people need it. So I'm able to leverage my time better by being able to talk to a lot of people at one time versus one person at a time. So it all came together to work out.
Well, that's great. I love that story. So tell us now how the course works specifically.
Yeah, so the course is called Rest, Digest, and Heal. It's a 7-module self-paced course. So there's 7 different categories I talk about in each module, one being certainly food, but one is movement. I talk about herbs and supplements. I talk about toxic load and personal care products and those types of things. Each one has a different theme, but it's self-paced. It's not in a cohort where people need to move through all together. Anybody can join at any time. And along with those modules, each are an hour, hour and a half. There's also a resource guide PDF that goes with each one. So everything that I'm talking about in these course modules, my goal is to have really practical, usable tips of how to put all this into practice. I think the thing that is really important to me and makes the course stand out is that it's not just about the information. There's so much information free out there on the internet. Everything you'd want to know, I'm sure you could find out on the internet, including through a course. And what I really am passionate about is the focus on not just information, but getting people the connection, the resources, the support they need to actually put this information into practice. Probably a lot of your listeners are really aware and have a lot of knowledge, but some of us, myself included, which is part of how this course came to be, can get into a little bit of a loop of wanting more and more information, wanting more knowledge, but that doesn't necessarily get you where you want to go. And sometimes it can actually make you spin your wheels too much and you're really not sure what direction to take. And that certainly has happened to me in my life, which is part of how I got to where I am in my practice and with this course and in my own personal health. This pursuit of eating perfectly or doing everything right actually got me so wound up and so stressed and depleted that it made my health worse. And I really want to help people go in a different direction with finding freedom from their symptoms, but also with food. With that being said, the support piece is really built in because in addition to just the online course, every week there's a group coaching call with me. It's an online meeting that anybody can go to. It's certainly not required to do to be in the course, but you can ask me anything, no matter where you are at in the course, even if you haven't started the modules, or if you never do the modules, if you just are like, I would want to be able to just ask me anything every week. So it's an hour meeting once a week that anybody can hop on and ask questions. If people can't come, it's recorded and they can watch a replay or anything like that. But I really wanted this to be different and not just throw more information at people and then they're like, what do I do with all this? But trying to make it super manageable, super practical. That's the feedback I've gotten so far. We only launched in April, so it's still a baby, but the big feedback I've gotten is it's super practical and you're able to take the information I'm giving and put it into practice and use the resources and use the connection with me to make it actually work for you. So it's a long way to describe it, but
right. Well, I like details, 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 as I was told in my class at college. And so you have, as you explained, the support sessions where people can ask you any questions. At your regular sessions, is it interactive or is it more of just people listening to what you say?
Anybody can ask anything at any point. Some people are really introverted and don't really want to hop on and chat, and that's fine too. But yeah, anybody can ask anything at any time. So those I really have left, and it's still new, so who knows what iterations it will take, but I've really wanted to leave it really open-ended and just there for answering questions or people getting more resources and more connections so that all the information is really usable for them and works for wherever they're at. We do lots of chatting.
Nice. I like that. So anyone who may feel uncomfortable sharing their issues with everyone, they don't have to, but for those that want to, they get that, which I think is a great way to run it.
Yeah, folks who don't want to share, or maybe the question's more personal, or whatever the nature of the barrier is, they have the option to email me questions anonymously or not, and I can answer them during the group coaching call, but no one will know who asked it. I've really tried to learn to understand the introverts in my life. That's not me, but I'm learning. So trying to make accommodations for all the different types of folks.
Wonderful. Yes, because I think that that's probably a concern a lot of people have of doing these classes where it's in a group that they have to share it. So I like the structure that you have it.
Yeah, thank you.
As you touched upon earlier, you saw a lot of people who would say they have the same problems. I think maybe that's just part of how I see digestive issues as big problems for a lot of different people. And one of the biggest reasons I think that is because there's disagreements of what causes digestion. And yeah, as you and I are both Weston A. Price chapter leaders, we obviously differ from the mainstream. So what are some of the myths that you would say are associated with digestion?
Yes, myths. I love busting myths.
Me too.
I would say one of the biggest myths would be that there's certain foods, really nutrient-dense, healthy whole foods, that are bad for the gut. I hear vegans and vegetarians say, or a number of people say, that meat is bad for the gut. You've maybe heard this myth that it sits and rots in the colon.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And just the whole thing that you eat too much fat, you're going to have digestive issues.
Yeah. And if you don't have a gallbladder or your liver sluggish, I guess you could. But this notion that meat is hard to digest or your body can't digest it and it just sits and rots in the colon. Absolutely not true. Meat is one of the easiest foods to digest, especially when we slow cook it, which is obviously, as we know, a very traditional way to prepare meats, but it is very easy to digest. It does not sit and rot in the colon. Humans are, of course, with the name of this podcast, humans are omnivores. We are created to digest and assimilate the nutrients from meat, animal, and plant foods. So yeah, this myth behind that is got to be busted. I would say similarly, things like dairy or wheat, these foods can be totally healthy, but the myth I'm busting is that there's blanket statement over certain whole foods being bad for digestion. There's so much context and so much nuance that meat, I'm just going to say, great for digestion, but something like dairy, it would depend on maybe your genetics if you have lactose intolerance or what kind of dairy you're consuming. There's a whole list of things that can vary with that. Or with wheat, I see lots of just, okay, eliminate gluten and I guess your digestion just automatically gets better. Certainly if you have celiac or for wheat allergy, it will, but just the average person who's looking to heal their digestion does not need to just cut out gluten. There's lots to look at there. Is the wheat been treated with pesticides? Is it sourdough bread? What additives are in the bread? There's so many things. So I can't think of really any whole real food that's just blanket bad for digestion. Even sugar, you know, I really don't see any reason to believe that just that sugar and carbohydrates are bad for digestion. Certainly, we'd want to pick whole food sources that have other nutrients and moderate our intake and balance with our physical activity. And again, context, nuance, but there's no category of real food that's bad for digestion. So that would be a myth to bust.
In regards to sugar, would you even include cane sugar, or would you narrow it down more to ones which use natural sweeteners such as honey, whole cane sugar, coconut sugar?
Yeah, certainly the bulk of your sweetener intake should be whole food sweeteners. Like you said, maple syrup, honey, coconut sugar, unrefined cane sugar, which is also called sucanat. Those would be the bulk. But I don't think that having an organic cane sugar that's not sucanat every once in a while, I don't think is trashing your digestion. I read a study where they're looking at different things that were prebiotic. So fibers and their breakdown products that feed beneficial gut microbes or feed gut microbes. And basically sucrose was one. So even the good bacteria eat sugar. But because of the other reasons to moderate your sugar intake, that's why I would choose those whole food sources. But I wouldn't say just going on a sugar-free diet will cure your digestive ailments. Believe me, I've done every diet under the sun, including keto, including no sugar, all this kind of stuff. And this was 12 or more years ago. And I was like, if I have the perfect diet, quote unquote perfect, which means there's nothing in there that anyone could consider bad, then my digestive problems are going to get better. But they really, truly only got worse because I was so engrossed in this perfectionism that my body couldn't heal because I was always in fight or flight. That's really the crux of this course is it's called Rest, Digest, and Heal. But the stress and digestion connection is the most important thing to focus on. And food supports that. But the pursuit of a nutritious diet can't be at the sake of your stress levels. But yes, whole food sources of sugar are the best.
Yes, there's really no disagreement from me there. I see even some cane sugar as okay in moderation, and especially it's important, I'm sure, as you know, as you have a kid and as your child gets older, that they're going to want sweets. So that's important. You've covered on three areas that I stress also, which there is some debate within the ancestral food world, as you bring up keto. And what I love about Weston A. Price Foundation is that they do not disclude dairy, grains, or sweets. They all talk about the proper way to prepare them. Now, I would say also that perhaps with meat, the preparation may have some to do with it. I don't know how much of a difference it makes, but I would think that certainly for the best digestion, you'd want grass-fed and pasture meats versus the corn-fed beef and the confined pork and chicken and turkey.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly if someone's budget is really limited and they can only afford the cheapest animal products, I'm like, those are still more nutrient dense and healing than the cheapest versions of grains and
yes, 100%.
And things like that. But if someone can prioritize in their budget, choosing the highest quality meats that have been, like you said, raised on pasture, not been given antibiotics and hormones, and have been raised properly, those absolutely are going to be more supportive to digestion. Really, it's in part because of they're just more nutrient dense. There's a better balance of fats. There's more vitamins and minerals in them. So there's that nutrient dense piece. But I think on the other end, it's, as you mentioned, how they're raised and how they're being treated and fed. We know that pesticides like glyphosate, like atrazine, have a negative impact on our gut microbiome. So consuming plant and animal foods that have pesticide residues in them is going to have an effect on our microbiome. Now, is it every once in a while you go out to eat and the meat there isn't organic, but you're like, well, at least I'm not just having French fries or whatever. Yes, get the meat. But that is totally within the margin of error, the 80-20 rule, but really trying to make the most mindful, high quality choices 80% of the time. But that's when those high-quality meats come in. That should be the bulk of what we're eating if we can possibly do it.
Right. I think we're on the same page that you don't have to go for perfection with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, if someone is really in a mode of healing where their gut is extremely compromised, that 80-20 rule might not really apply to them. But I would say for almost everyone I've seen in my practice over the last 10 years, it does. You're going to a potluck or family's having a dinner or you're going out to eat with friends or whatever, certainly we can make better choices within that context. Like I said, maybe not getting fried foods unless you're lucky enough to go to a place that has a tallow fryer or something, but being like, yeah, this isn't the best meat, but at least it's going to give me some nutrients and you've got to eat something. I think the 80-20 rule of 80% of the time you're choosing properly prepared foods, things that are raised really high quality, nutrient dense plant and animal foods. If you're doing that 80% of the time, the other 20% when you're having a little bit of flexibility, a little bit of fun, a little bit of not being in control, you're usually going to be just fine. There's certainly a few foods that I'm kind of like, really, for me, these are never foods, but maybe for some people, that's not really feasible. Things like food coloring.
Yes.
High fructose corn syrup. I'm like, I know I can avoid this and still be pretty flexible. But that's a choice everyone's going to make on their own.
In terms of other ones that are never foods, would you include seed oils on that?
I really avoid them. I would say 99% of the time I avoid them. I would say if we have them, it's because I didn't realize there was mayonnaise on something. Or the amount would be so small that the perfectionist in me is like, I never want to have these because I don't want to be out of balance with my omega-6s, all this, and they're really processed. But the reality is I'm sure they pass my lips sometimes, but I'm not seeing down to French fries or something that I know has been cooked in canola or other types of oils. That's definitely one we really avoid at all costs. I live in the middle of nowhere in Wisconsin, so I don't go out to eat a lot. We just have so much food from our own homestead and other farmers that we know that we love to cook at home. But yeah, it happens every once in a while. There's a lot of apple orchards around here. Our area is famous for that. And there's a place that has apple cider donuts and they're made with non-organic apples and they're fried in canola oil. But I have one a year because it's a special fun thing. So you know what I mean? That's so few and far between that I really am like, you know what? I don't think any harm will befall me.
I don't think so either. Seed oils are very hard to avoid in restaurants, especially for foods such as French fries and even a lot of these ones that say they use tallow. Research has been done and it turns out that a lot of times they do still start with a seed oil base. So it's hard to find ones that are 100% in tallow. For people that have mostly avoided restaurants or they don't have a lot in their area, it's also been somewhat hard unless you want to make your own fries from scratch. Although we are seeing a few more companies now that cook fries in tallow and avocado oil and other healthy oils, ones such as Roots Farm Fresh, Jesse and Ben's, Folkland Foods. But for people who have digestive issues, is it best to limit any kind of fried food, even if it is cooked in the good fats, the healthy oils?
No, I wouldn't say so. Unless someone has issues digesting fats, then that's just going to be a pretty big wallop of even good fat. So if someone has had their gallbladder removed and has trouble digesting fats, or some people with upper GI issues like GERD or reflux, those types of things, sometimes fried foods irritate that condition, even if it's healthy fats. If there's sluggishness in the liver, or maybe there's some blockage in the gallbladder, if there's gallstones, those types of things where fats are not well digested, I would say avoiding fried foods. But for the general person who maybe their issues more IBS, constipation, that kind of thing, I would say enjoying fried foods. If they're fried in tallow or lard, it seems fine. But like you said, hard to find.
Right. And in terms of other myths, I know that a commonly held belief about digestive issues is often high stomach acid, but there's been some debate about that. Actually, others have said that it's low stomach acid that causes it. What is your take?
Yeah, that's so true. If someone has heartburn or reflux or the condition known as GERD, that's been a long-held belief that it's because of too much stomach acid. So that's where we're giving proton pump inhibitors. There's a lot of medications that fall into that category with the idea that they would decrease the stomach acid and therefore this condition would go away. But over the last several years, people are really noticing that it's actually more people having low stomach acid. And a lot of these symptoms are coming up because the stomach acid is too low and the stomach is almost churning, trying to break down your food, but it can't do it because it doesn't have enough acid. So the stomach acid should be acidic enough to break down proteins and everything that you're eating quite a bit. The stomach should be very acidic. And if the stomach acid is too low, things are not going to break down properly. So they're going to sit in the stomach and be coming up because they're not moving through at a proper speed. So even with people with low stomach acid, PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, will help some of their symptoms in the short term, but it does not correct the issue of low stomach acid. Low stomach acid can be from many things. It can be from dysbiosis, so an imbalance of good and bad bacteria in the gut, including in the stomach. It can be from stress primarily, I think we see as a huge one. So the body being in fight or flight all the time diverts energy away from the digestive system and into the parts of your body you would need for fight or flight. So the muscles, the heart, and the digestive system can't function properly, and it can't be in balance with putting out the stomach acid it needs, making digestive enzymes, keeping a healthy mucous membrane and those junctions in the intestine nice and tight so there's no leaky gut. It can't prioritize digestion and keeping that healthy if we're always in fight or flight. And so I think that's a huge reason we're seeing low stomach acid.
Yes. And actually, I can speak to that personally. When I had terrible acid reflux and I kept being prescribed different pharmaceuticals and was not noticing actually any difference at all. And then someone from the holistic nutrition world says, try HCL. And that was the first thing that actually made a difference.
Mm, yeah. So certainly finding herbs, supplements, foods that support those symptoms, and then figuring out the root cause of why is my stomach acid low. I like to talk about how there's never just one root cause. We are a product of our whole lives. So whatever got us here is usually multiple factors. But yeah, it's usually stress, insults to the microbiome, lack of proper nourishment, which usually for a lot of people, especially in our generation, started when we were kids. So things like betaine hydrochloride, if the stomach acid is low, can be great to supplement to get things properly digesting and moving through. And then going back to those kind of three main root cause categories and going, okay, what do I need to address here so that it doesn't come back?
And so as we both agree that it's often due to low stomach acid, not high stomach acid, I think we could rule out when they say to avoid foods such as tomatoes or citrus fruits or mints as a way to have better digestion.
Certainly. I will say, however, that some people, even with the low stomach acid, do need to avoid high acid foods because their stomach lining is so degraded and sensitive. And so, yeah, the myth around eating these acidic foods is that it makes the stomach too acidic. So definitely I would agree on that. But I would say I also had a period of my life that was extremely stressful, and I had really bad gastritis. So not a lot of necessarily the heartburn, some heartburn and reflux symptoms, but a lot of pain in the stomach. I know it was stress. It was during 2020, so pretty stressful. And I couldn't have red wine. I couldn't eat tomatoes or vinegar or these types of things. And I knew it was just because the lining of my stomach was so inflamed and the mucous membrane had probably been degraded through low stomach acid, imbalance of microbiome, stress. And so these high acid foods really caused more pain. But I know that those aren't the cause, and they certainly don't make the stomach too acidic. So definitely what you're saying, the acidity of tomatoes or something is no match for the acidity of stomach acid. So really the only reason you would avoid those is if you notice symptoms when you eat them. And if so, that's usually because there's just a lot of inflammation and irritation in either the esophagus or the stomach or both.
Yes. A few other ones that conventional medicine will say are problematic to the stomach and to digestion are alcohol, spicy foods, chocolate, and coffee. What are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, chocolate, coffee, spicy foods, I think would all fit in the category of what I just talked about. Is they would only really be irritating if you already had a lot of inflammation and there was the mucous membrane, which coats the entirety of the digestive system. If that is degraded through not having a good balance of microbes that build it up and having a lot of inflammation, if that is degraded or if there's lots of irritation, those foods can be irritating to some people. They were for me when I was dealing with my issues. It's healed and I can enjoy those foods again because those are some of my favorites. But yeah, those could be irritating because it's already irritated. Alcohol is such an interesting one. If you are a proponent of moderate alcohol intake, you can find a study that supports that. And if you're a proponent of complete abstinence from alcohol, you can find studies that support that too, right? But one thing, thinking of our Weston Price and traditional foods wisdom, is all traditional cultures consumed alcohol.
Yes.
Were they going on benders and drinking out of kegs at parties and consuming a lot of hard alcohol? Absolutely not. But wine and traditionally brewed beers and meads and hard ciders certainly were a part of absolutely every culture's diet. I'm the fermentation queen. And these are fermented foods, right? So this is how they preserved a lot of foods. And maybe it was before a lot of water was potable, but I have to imagine that the traditional people that we know had extremely robust digestive health and a really diverse microbiome consume some alcohol. So I would say I'm a believer in the alcohol in moderation cap. But again, as we talked about context and nuance with some of these other foods, like choosing whenever you can organic wine.
Yes, organic I was beer. Thinking that too. Yes, yeah. you're reading my mind because that was actually where I wanted to go. And yeah, there are some more organic wines. We've seen even some regenerative wines. Organic beer, not a lot, although Patagonia Provisions I know has some type of regenerative beer. But I was going to say that this calls for, since a big part of my blog is recommending products on the market, but I also do encourage everyone to make things from home from scratch if they can. So I was going to say now it's really popular, the whole home brewing and home winemaking, to encourage some people to maybe look into that.
Yeah, absolutely. I love fermenting. I love teaching fermenting and that DIY spirit, whether it's making pickles. We were talking before we started recording about how I've made 11 gallons of pickles this summer. People should be trying to do things on their own as much as they can for so many reasons. It actually makes our brain happy when we do things with our hands and do things for ourselves. So if you love fermenting, then yeah, fermenting your own wines and ciders and meads and beers, I think, is a great next step in a way to know exactly what's in the product. And also just, it's fun to learn a skill. But yes, finding organic beer is very difficult. There's one brewery, I'm in Southwest Wisconsin. There's a brewer in Madison that does organic beer called Giant Jones. But other than that, it's so few and far between. I'm a wine person, not just because of that, but that's a big reason. It's really hard to find organic beer. But there's lots of organic ciders and some great meads and things like that. If you're going to consume alcohol, again, choose high quality, either organic, biodynamic wines or other alcohols. And again, quantity, context. Are you having a glass of wine with dinner with your friends? Figuring out why you're consuming alcohol, it certainly has to do with how it has an effect on you as well. How we think and feel about the things we consume, the food and drink we consume, has a direct impact on how it affects our body. So if we're consuming something because, even if it's food, if someone's a stress eater or drinking to drink their cares away or whatever, how the mindset we're in when we consume things, even if they are healthy, for sure impacts how we digest it and how it affects our body and our symptoms. And even if it's a healthy food and we're eating it in an appropriate amount, if we feel anxiety about it, or say someone who's been low carb for a long time or has really believed that they need to be grain-free or low carb or something to be healthy, and then they really are like, I'm not getting enough carbohydrates to support my activity or whatever I'm needing it for, my thyroid, I want to start incorporating it. If you go into that meal with a lot of anxiety or guilt or whatever negative feeling, that food is going to impact you much more than if you're like, hey, this is a healthy food, I have no reason to fear it, it's going to support my body. Those same food, same body, could have totally different impacts on symptoms. If somebody has a lot of bloating or whatever digestive issue they have, just the difference in those two scenarios could have a totally different impact on those symptoms. Because again, you were getting into which mode of your nervous system you're in. Are you in rest and digest, or are you in fight or flight? You really can't be in both at the same time. And your body needs to feel safe and calm as much as you can when you're eating to have optimal digestion. It's not just about what you're eating. So I would say the same is true for whatever you're eating or drinking, that being in a good mindset, a positive, healthy mindset, and being in a calm state when you're eating is one of the most important things you can do for digestion. So I'll tie that back to myths. A myth would be you can have the perfect diet and your digestion will be good. Absolutely not. Your healthy diet has to be in the context of a lifestyle that helps you be calm and happy as much as possible, especially while you're eating and around food and mealtimes. But the more you are in rest and digest, the better your body's going to heal, because your body can't heal if it doesn't feel safe. And you can't properly digest your food if it doesn't feel safe. So that's something we dig a lot into that in the course, but it's a myth I like to bust, which is, yeah, that the perfect diet will lead to perfect health. And I am here to tell you, as someone who's strived for that as a young person, now that I'm older and have healed myself, I can tell you that's not true.
A very big myth that you've just busted. I love it. And this takes me back to when we first met, when I saw you give that presentation at the Ancestral Health Symposium, and you talked very much about before you eat, you talked about the idea of a lot of religions say a prayer before you eat, and even if you're not religious, to in some way do something similar, reflect on everything before you eat the meal. Don't just rush into eating it.
Yeah, absolutely. The practice of pausing reflecting, taking some breaths, calming down right before your meal absolutely is really important for getting you into that mode of, okay, my body can prioritize digestion right now. And that having gratitude, which is often what is happening during a blessing or a grace or whatever different people call it, we're offering gratitude, whether it's for having something to eat in general or for the company we have or the farmers and the animals or the plants, the things that are feeding us. Gratitude is like a switch that flips you out of fight or flight and into rest and digest. So a lot of us who maybe grew up doing a blessing before a meal didn't know the effect it was having on our nervous system, but it certainly was. And especially, not to sound, I don't know, but in these modern times, everything's fast-paced and there's a lot of stimulation from technology, our screens and all that kind of stuff. Or if you have kids, maybe they've been running around while you're cooking dinner or whatever it is, taking that couple of moments before you eat is just really grounding and calming and centering. And it's like, okay, I'm switching into this mode of it's time to eat and it's time to prioritize calmness over everything else. So creating a really nice eating environment, whatever that means for you. It certainly doesn't mean being on your phone while you're doom scrolling or while you're eating, or everybody has to eat on the go sometimes, but eating half your meals in the car or whatever people do who have to commute, these types of things, it's like, these are not conducive to good digestion. So yeah, if nothing else, no matter where you're at, taking a few moments to pause and reflect, have some gratitude and just get centered before your meal, it can make a world of difference.
Yes. And we've talked a lot about how a lot of foods that we're told are bad for digestion are myths. Are there any foods that you would say people with digestive issues should include more in their diet that maybe they're not?
Oh, sure. We talked about fermented foods a lot, so that would be one of my biggies.
Yeah, that's the first one that comes to mind for me, too.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Fermented foods can be a lot of different things. It could be yogurt and kefir. It could be sauerkraut and pickles. It could be kombucha. There's lots of different types of fermented foods, but we know that they offer benefit as we digest them. The beneficial bacteria and other things they contain help us as we digest them. My general recommendation is to include something fermented with each meal. Even if it's just a small amount, that's going to help you. The other thing about fermented foods and digestion is that fermented foods are often themselves easier to digest than their non-fermented counterparts. So thinking of cabbage or some fermented vegetable, super fibrous cabbage. Some people, you may be experiencing gas or bloating after eating it. Once you ferment it, it's much more easily digested. Similar with sourdough bread or fermented dairy in the forms of yogurt or kefir, those harder to digest parts of those foods like lactose in dairy or gluten and starches in bread, once they are fermented, are much easier to digest. So definitely fermented foods. The other top, this I could talk about a long time, but the other ones would be, right, would be slow cooked meat stocks. Some people use bone broth, but it doesn't have to be just with bones. I'm a really big proponent of making your broths and stocks out of something that has some meat on it to have the most collagen available. Those are the two biggest ones. And then ample animal protein for sure. If someone told me I had to say only three, those would be the three. Of course, there's many more. So fermented foods, stocks and broths, and plenty of animal protein.
Yes, fermented foods, a very important one. I think one of the best. And it's also probably one of the ones that a lot of people are not including in their diet. For me, I have no problem with including more fermented foods because I'm what's known as a sour tooth. I love the bitter taste. For others, it may be different. But like you said, they are easier to digest. And Natasha Campbell McBride explained it well of why they are, because with fermented foods, they're fermented, so there's microbes and bacteria that were already digesting them to begin with.
Yeah.
That then makes it easier in our bodies.
Yeah, exactly. The fibers are starting to be broken down. Some of the sugars and starches are starting to be broken down. So for some people, it makes them easier to digest. It also lowers the glycemic index of something like bread. It also adds vitamins to them that weren't there before fermentation. So yes, they're pre-broken down through those microbes. Some of those harder to digest elements are pre-broken down. But during that fermentation, those microbes also produce, as basically a metabolic byproduct, things like vitamin K2 and vitamin B12. So there's a host of reasons to ferment your foods. If you're not consuming them, that's something I would say to start doing right away. The only thing I would say is if someone has a histamine intolerance, which can be healed through doing some serious gut healing, but if someone has a histamine intolerance, fermented foods are not going to be helpful to them and they can cause more symptoms. So until they've healed that and are in balance so they can break down and detoxify histamines that come from foods, that would be someone who a probiotic supplement would be more appropriate. But for everyone else, I'm like, yeah, go nuts with fermenting. I'm also probably a sour tooth. I don't know if I've heard that term, but I have been since I was very little.
Well, we can thank Tim Richards of Philosopher Foods, who was on this program a couple months ago. He introduced me to that term and a whole other group of terms I'd never heard of.
Oh, it's fun to learn more things, that's for sure.
Oh, yes. Well, that episode, as I explained, we need a glossary for it before anyone goes into listening to it. Yes. And another thing that I often hear to include for people with digestive issues is more fiber. Do you think that one is something that's needed?
Ooh, fiber's tricky. The evidence is pretty clear that adequate fiber intake is good for digestion. The microbes in our gut, they break down the fiber and eat that. That's what prebiotics are, different types of fibers and carbohydrates that they eat. So we absolutely need them. The thing I will say, though, is I wouldn't just have anybody, especially if they have a compromised digestive system, I wouldn't just advise someone to go out and get their 30, 40, 50 grams of fiber a day to start out. If somebody's had a low fiber diet, just from maybe a standard American diet, a lot of processed foods, you would want to introduce that gradually so you don't get uncomfortable symptoms. It wouldn't necessarily mean it's bad for you, but if you haven't had a lot of fiber and you're introducing a lot, you can get gas, bloating, constipation, those types of things. So yes, fiber is good. If you haven't had a lot, introduce it slowly. The other side of this is that if someone has a really compromised digestion, a lot of fiber usually makes their symptoms worse. So if someone has a histamine intolerance, they would need to do some gut healing so that they can handle the adequate amount of fiber to feed their gut microbes. So that doesn't mean I would say someone necessarily needs to be on a no fiber diet. I wouldn't say that, but I liken fiber intake to weightlifting. Eating fiber is like lifting weights for your digestive system. It's good for it. It makes it strong. It gives it what it needs to build up the gut microbes. However, if you had a broken leg, you wouldn't be going to do squats and deadlifts and all these different things. Similarly, if you have a really compromised, inflamed digestive system, lots of constipation or diarrhea, then fiber is really only going to make it worse and not help you. So smaller amounts of fiber, focusing on soluble fiber, which is the kind that feeds the gut microbes, isn't the kind that creates bulk in the stool. Those would be the ones to focus on and gradually increasing as your gut heals. But definitely, as with everything I talk about, it's all about nuance and context. And I would say that is a general myth that more fiber is better. If your gut is healthy, that can certainly help maintain a healthy gut microbiome. Getting enough fiber is important to achieve a healthy gut microbiome. But like I said, if it's really compromised, you've got to go really minimal on the fiber and only focus on really the soluble fibers as much as you can until your body can handle it.
A key point about soluble fiber as opposed to any fiber, and I think even soluble fiber is a very broad term. There are many types of it, and I imagine that the type of soluble fiber you would not recommend is things such as those high-fiber cereals. And if you look at it, going back to ferments, sauerkraut definitely has a good amount of fiber in it.
Sure, especially if you eat as much as I do. No. Yeah, if someone is looking to increase their fiber intake, I would start with, yes, whole foods, fermented foods, things like root vegetables and fruit. Properly prepared oats are great places to start with, are good sources of soluble fiber. Now, yeah, I wouldn't start with necessarily fiber powders, or definitely not foods that just have fiber shoehorned in there, like you said, the cereals and the bars. And I would start with whole foods and certainly, yeah, fermented foods. But oats are really high in soluble fiber. So if you have soaked or sprouted or both oats to make an oatmeal, that could be a good way to get more soluble fiber. But yeah, I'm a big fan of root vegetables, tubers, and fruit for doing that as well.
Yes, oatmeal, which is really the only type of cereal you should eat. And it's essentially the original cereal. And what happened really with all foods was oatmeal, traditionally, people would soak it for a long time. I don't know if maybe it was 24 hours. And cereal was basically a way to find shortcuts to have that kind of food. You had it ready made with this high extrusion process.
Yeah, the industrialization of food has been such a contributing factor to the gut dysfunction. Again, there's always more than one factor, but that's a huge one because, like you said, the shortcuts. So how things are grown, how things are prepared and processed. At every turn, there's been decisions made and changes happen that have really made things harder to digest and less nutrient dense.
We've taken the bulk of time on this program talking all about the foods you should have and what you should avoid, or at least have less of if you have gut issues. There are also other things that are recommended, such as, I know one of the things is digestive bitters. What are your thoughts on those?
I absolutely love them. I could talk about them all day, Aaron. We could probably do a whole show on bitters maybe someday, but I love them. It's one of the first things I have people take usually. Again, this isn't medical advice. I can't recommend anything without talking to someone, but I would say the vast majority of clients I've worked with, one of the first things I do is have them take bitters. Digestive bitters, bitter herbs extracted in an alcohol solution. There's lots of different brands out there, some really great ones. No surprise, I make my own, but there's lots out there that I could sing the praises for. The bitter taste is one that's been lost in the modernization of the diet and industrialization of foods. And we don't necessarily need a lot of the bitter taste, but we absolutely do need it. We need all the taste. That's why we have all the taste receptors, the taste buds. The bitter taste receptors, which are not just on the tongue, which I think is really fascinating. Most of our taste buds, also known as receptors, are on the tongue, but there are bitter receptors throughout the digestive system. They've also been found in the lungs and the brain. So these foods with bitter taste in the realm of herbs, that would be things like maybe dandelion or burdock. Those are really popular ones. In the world of foods, things like a hoppy beer, a dark chocolate, a black coffee, mustard greens or dandelion greens, those types of things. When those bitter taste receptors are signaled by these foods, they essentially send a signal to our body to secrete the digestive juices and to get gut motility. So how things move through the gut, they signal them to move. So you could have a cabinet full of supplements, but for a lot of people, a digestive bitters formula and really nice balanced formula can take the place of a lot of things. For some people, including betaine hydrochloride, digestive enzyme capsules, other types of things, because it's so powerful. It signals everything to secrete and move. I like to take them maybe 15, 20 minutes before a meal to signal digestion to get started. And then you can also take them as symptoms arise as well.
And in terms of supplements, because I know we've talked mostly about foods, also the recommendation of digestive bitters, are there some supplements that you do see as beneficial for digestion?
Yeah, and it certainly depends on the person. No two people are going to be alike, but some supplements I see on repeat in my practice are things like cod liver oil. I mean, how could we have a discussion without talking about cod liver oil? For the fat-soluble vitamins and for the omega-3 fatty acids, I also use, if folks aren't eating organ meats, for whatever reason, if they just can't do it, they didn't grow up with it, then things like liver capsules or other organ meat capsules. There's lots of different organs out there, but liver is probably the most popular one you'll find in like desiccated capsules.
The most beneficial too. Of the organ.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So nutrient dense. Magnesium, in terms of one that's actually I don't want to say synthetic, but one that's really processed, I guess, to say magnesium can be really beneficial, especially if folks have constipation, if they have a lot of maybe anxiety or sleeplessness. Magnesium can be really supportive for a few reasons. One of them being magnesium citrate is a laxative. So if somebody is chronically constipated, that can be helpful to just get things going. And again, as the gut heals and you prevent the constipation, but magnesium citrate is a mildly laxative. I wouldn't call it pharmaceutical grade, like Miralax or something, but it's nice and gentle. Also, our soil agricultural practices we have now is pretty depleted in magnesium. So supplementing with that can be a way to offset that. And our body kind of excretes magnesium when we're under stress. So again, this is where another stress piece comes in. If someone's chronically stressed for whatever reason, their body's basically wasting magnesium and needs more magnesium than someone who is more in a calm and regulated state more of the time. So there's multi-factor reason someone might need to supplement with magnesium. That's another one. Yeah, there's many I would say, but I guess the last one I would say, again, there's many I could list, but we only have so much time or else I could just talk to you all day. But the last one I would say is colostrum, which is taken from the first milk. Usually it's cows that I've seen, and it's extremely nutrient dense, but there's properties in this colostrum, as you can imagine, that really support the immune system, and especially a marker called secretory IgA, which is a marker of the gut's own innate immune system. And that's out of balance, a lot can go wrong. So colostrum is another one that I've seen on repeat. There's lots of other herbs that aren't bitters. And I try to go food first, and then I use herbs before other supplements, because herbs are food. We're just preparing them in medicinal ways. But to me, that's still a food. And so I try to use herbs whenever I can. But certainly things like liver and colostrum, magnesium still come into play.
Excellent. I think you've given a great view overall of the myths about digestion and what is really needed to solve the digestive issues. You obviously have a great passion for gut health and for real food. I know another one of your passions is NFL football and the Kansas City Chiefs. And as Football season is starting in a few days. How do you think the Chiefs are going to do this year?
Oh, you found maybe the only uncrunchy thing about me, Erin, but I'm loud and proud about it. I will be barefoot in a linen dress, eating homemade pickles and watching the NFL. But yes, I'm from Kansas City originally, so my allegiance is not Taylor Swift related, although no shade to her. I'm just saying, I was OG, but I think they're going to do fantastic. I think if it's Travis Kelce's last year, he's got something to prove. I think there's some great, fresh talent. I think losing last year was something that they're going to try to make up for, and I'm excited to watch it.
Sounds great. Me too, yes. I like the Chiefs too. Andy Reid is from Parton, L.A., not too far from where I live, so go Chiefs.
Yeah, well, how are your Browns going to do?
I think that they have potential to do well this year. I think they got a nice young team along with some existing talent, so I'm hopeful for them to have a good season.
Yeah, hope is good.
Absolutely. We'll see that how I feel about this in a month from now. But before the season starts, I want to feel optimistic.
Yes.
We're just about out of time. But before we go, let the listeners know where they can go online to learn about your practice and your new online course, as well as any social media to learn more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. The course, as we've said, is called Rest, Digest, and Heal. So you can find it at restdigestandheal.com. If you go there, of course, you can get all the information, sign up for either a monthly membership, annual membership, or the one-on-one private coaching, which includes the course as well. If you do one-on-one private practice with me, you also get the course included in that. But when you go to the website, there will be a pop-up for a free mini course called the 5-Minute Gut Health Makeover. It's also 7 modules, and each one is a 5-minute mini version of the course. So you get lots of information for free, but also a good peek into what the course is like to see if you want to dive even deeper. So that's out there. And if someone wants to follow me on social media, I am the Crunchy RD, the period Crunchy period RD on Instagram. I'm learning to do Instagram, but I'm on there, and yeah, come find me, reach out, message me on Instagram with questions. And yeah, I hope to see some listeners and a group coaching call sometime.
Excellent. Laura, it's been a pleasure having you on and sharing all your knowledge with us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. It's been super fun, and I'm really grateful. Thank you.
Perfect. That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. New episodes of the show released every Wednesday. Follow me on social media for more information on the next episode. And to make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore on your favorite podcast site or app. You can also listen to all my podcasts on my website, appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. Until next time, my pantry is officially closed.